My favorite correspondent who sends me the best information, Jeb Card, he listens to some of these radio shows, and he listened to Banal of America. Is that how you pronounce it, Tim Banal? I never listened to it, but
no idea.
Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for Banal of America? Live!
Sharon apparently has. Let's see, she's up. She's on this week's episode of Banal of America, which I'm not familiar with. But.
Oh, well, it's a paranormal podcast. And it's a good 2.5 hours long. I was on the phone for 2 hours and 1 minute. And we could have been on longer. It was fantastic to talk to somebody of a different perspective. There was some overlap where you're talking to somebody of the paranormal approach, and you could really see that there's a lot of common ground there, and it's really a shame that we don't have a bridge to talk more.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, really no comparison. This is Tim Banal with another edition of BOA Audio Season 8 and the first live edition of Season 8. As I teased you at the end of the season premiere of the program last week, really only a handful of days ago, BOA Audio Season 8 is all about the taped shows and the live shows. And one of the big goals of the live shows is to bring back some of our favorite guests from the past 7 seasons and talk to them, get updates about their work, talk to them about what they've been up to since we last heard from them. And that's what we're doing here tonight on the first live edition of Season 8 with our old buddy here, Sharon Hill from Delphal News. She's the editor and creator of Delphal News and clutch your pearls now, folks. She is a skeptic, if you did not hear her on the previous appearance on the program. And I'm really psyched to have you back on the show, Sharon. I hope you can do another 2 hours with me. I know it's going to be a marathon, but I think we're going to have fun.
I'm good. Let's go.
Wow. Wow. This is not a game show. Just relax.
No, all right.
So, you know, we made a big to-do about it when we had you on BOA Audio season 7 back in the springtime, because you were the first skeptic we ever had on the show, and you know, it was kind of breaking some new ground. And I know you hadn't really done many forays into the world of paranormal radio. So,
right.
You know, what was the aftermath of your journey across the bridge, if you will?
Well, you heard that I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great.
Yeah.
And it was all good. And I really thought that we both made some good points, and it was clear that we had some common ground. And I think a lot of feedback from my end was good. There were a few people that just don't like to hear the skeptical point of view at all. They don't like to hear it in anything, and they'll have those. But for the most part, I thought it was such a measured conversation that there was nothing for people to get upset about or get angry about. So for the most part, the skeptical community, a couple people tuned into the show for the first time. I know they told me, and they found some other topics they were interested in. So I think that was good.
And, yeah, always good.
Yeah. On the other hand, and there's also people in the skeptic community that are very supportive. They say, you know, it's great that you go to these other shows because you're reaching out to a brand new audience that really just has no idea that we're not a bunch of grumpy old men sitting around yelling at the television or yelling at people to get off our lawn. Well, people, and we like these topics just as much as the believers do. We just take a different angle, a different approach. But for the most part, it's been a good year. I mean, I think that I've gotten a lot of new friends, social media friends in the paranormal, and I've exchanged some more conversations with them. So definitely a good start.
Nice, nice. I should have really started off with just a general, how have you been, what have you been up to? So, you know, let's do that. What have you, we'll just dive right in. Well, you pressured me with that, let's go. So I was like,
we'll
get right to the notes. No, it's all right, I'm just teasing you. So what have you been up to, you know, beyond the beyond the fourth wall smashing that we already engaged in, what have you been up to since we last heard from you, you know, at the very beginning of the year?
Well, I did a couple of conferences. I did some speaking at some conferences. Well, one was in New York City, another in Las Vegas. I think there was another one, and I can't quite recall. It was local. These were my biggest speaking events, I think, that I've ever done, you know, talking to well over 300 to 1,000 people.
Yeah, wow.
In the audience. And it turned out great. So I was talking about subjects sort of like we talked about, connecting with the paranormalists, how they view the world and what they're interested in and how they approach things with the way that the skeptic community would approach it as well, and why that's important for us to pay attention to. Because I'm talking to people who think that Bigfoot and UFOs and ghosts are silly to talk about. And I don't think that. I think it's important to talk about that, and we need to talk about that because it's popular in the culture today, and it's interesting and has a lot of meaning to it. And so that was my goal, was to bring these subjects to the skeptical community and say, this is why we should be engaging with people who believe in Bigfoot or who are out there looking for ghosts. And I did a panel. This was a conference in Las Vegas called The Amazing Meaning,
mm-hmm.
where I was participating in a panel on cryptozoology. And this year I've been lumped in with what's called the Bigfoot Skeptic.
Okay.
And it's almost like a bad label that you would get in high school, like a jock or, you know,
yeah.
a head or whatever. You know, it's not a great term because it's, oh, you just Bigfoot, that's just silly.
Now. Let me interrupt you there. Now I'm confused because you got tagged as a Bigfoot skeptic by the skeptic community, is what you're saying.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, see, I thought you meant just by the crypto community, like they were like, you know, oh, you're a mean girl. We don't, you know, you're mean. So
yeah, well, they think that too.
Yeah, they
think that.
but you're saying then, that. But you're saying, see, this is interesting. You're saying that. So they were like dismissive of you, like, oh, she's just, you know, she's just
right.
doing. Oh, that's lame.
Well, it's why do you waste your time on this stuff when there are more important things that you could be working on?
Oh, God.
And we've had this, a couple of us are the interested in cryptozoology, the skeptics, and we just love this stuff from when we were kids, and it's not going to go away tomorrow. It did go away in pop culture. It's not going to go away with us, so we're going to be interested in it.
Yeah.
And we have talks about this, and we're like, this is important stuff, and this is what we do. This is our niche. You guys could go over there, your doctors, you can talk about alt-med or quackery and stuff like this, stuff that you feel is serious, which is serious, no doubt.
Yeah.
But that's not my expertise, so I'm not going to talk about that as much. I'm going to talk about this because I love it and I want to talk about it some more.
Well, it's funny. I mean, you've decried sort of being accused of the one who takes the fun out of, you know, the cryptozoology and stuff, right? But on the other hand, it's like you're the one bringing the fun to the skeptic community.
When you hear people like Don Prothero and Daniel Loxton, Ben Redheffer talk about cryptozoology in these talks, we're excited and we think it's fun. You know, we just love this stuff. So I think it's just a nice break. We don't always want to be brought down by people dying from, using quackery instead of real cancer treatments. That's a downer. But it has to be said, of course. This
yeah.
is just, it's another aspect of society that we need to apply skepticism to. And, yeah, people say I'm the downer, but I just want the best answer. I'm not much of a mystery mongering. I just want the best answer.
Right.
And if that's
right.
so wrong, so what?
Well, it's interesting. It's like a degree of, like, their minds are made up, these people that are just, the skeptics who are dismissing you, it's like they're just like, it's open and shut. It's too ridiculous to even conjure up to look at it. And you're just sort of like, listen, you know, it doesn't seem like your mind's closed to the idea. It just seems like you haven't been presented with anything that makes you optimistic, let's say.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay.
And there are a lot of those skeptics who will just say, doesn't exist. Why are you wasting your time? I think it's more complicated than that.
I think so, clearly. It's just too bad that, you know, it's too bad that they feel that way. But, you know, that's why we have you on the show here, to learn more about these mysterious skeptics. There's mysterious to my listeners here as the as the Bigfoot. So where were you talking to 1,000 people? That was the amazing
meeting in Las Vegas that happens every year, and that's the major skeptical conference in the world. It's run by James Randi and his foundation, James Randi Educational Foundation, and I played a rather large part in it this year, having my own spot. I spoke right after Michael Shermer, which was cool, and then I had a panel, which I moderated, and then I was on another panel that I participated in, and it's just, it's been 4 days. Networking and coming up with new ideas. It's a lot of fun to be around people with like minds. That's where we go to conferences about, you know, your personal interest, whatever that may be.
Right.
Because it's just so great to be able to talk about this stuff where other people in your day-to-day life might look at you like you're weird. We can talk about this, and there's no limits. It's great.
Okay. All right. Now, you broke up a little bit on me there, so try not to walk around too much.
Oh, sorry.
If that's what you're doing.
No, I'm sitting here.
No. All right. No doing the laundry or anything while you're on the phone with me. I don't know what. I have to admit, someone already busted me in the chat room. I do have the Red Sox playoff game here on the TV. It's in my peripheral, so, you know, it's very, it's not distracting. It's less distracting than the chat room, actually, but it's all good. So 1,000 people, that's insane. That's like, that's madness. We talked about this on the last time you were on. It's like I told you, the skeptics are winning, I think, because I don't think you could get 1,000 people to a paranormal event. You know, maybe I'm mistaken. Maybe there's, if somebody knows of an event that gets 1,000 people, let me know. Maybe some ghost event somewhere. But I think the cap is maybe 300 to 400 people for a paranormal event. That's just, I'm sort of guessing.
Well, there are paracons that are, and they're different because they're more like fan conventions.
Right, right.
Where the skeptical conferences are not. They're speakers, they're panels, they're events, but it's not a fan Q&A type thing that you would see at, I've been to Dragon Con is massive, but it's the whole pile of different themes going on there. There is a paranormal track there, and they do get a lot of attention, but most of the rooms are small, but for the celebrities, paranormal celebrities, there's a lot of people.
What is a paranormal? Are we talking like people from Ghost Hunters and stuff like that?
Yes.
Oh, gross.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm
sure they get, I'm sure they have fantastic ratings and everything, but, those skeptics, they don't believe in Bigfoot. I don't believe in paranormal celebrities. Like, I just don't think, I guess at the end of the day, the Iron Sheik is a celebrity to some people, but to me, he'd probably be more of a celebrity, I guess, than a paranormal celebrity. But they're on par with the Iron Sheik, let's say. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Iron Sheik or not. But
I have a vague idea of who that is.
Right.
The thing about those paranormal celebrities is they'll go to these conferences. You know, the Josh Gate, the people from Ghost Hunters, John Zaffis.
Okay.
The Travis Walton. Although Travis Walton gave a talk. He didn't do a Q&A. But the para-celebrities will do a Q&A, and all they will do is just answer questions from the audience. How many times can you answer, what was your favorite episode, or what was the scariest moment? Or it's boring to listen to them.
I guess. But there's the weird part is there's people like there are people that are like dying to ask them. You know, it's a weird sort of thing. I don't know. I mean, aren't what they are doing the same as like what would happen with at the table for Michael Shermer or something? Wouldn't he be pestered with these questions about or the Mythbusters? Let's say that's probably a better example. What was your favorite episode of Mythbusters? They probably have to answer the same questions, but you're just saying. By by making that their entire reason for being at the event is a misnomer?
Well, I saw Grant Imahara at a presentation, which was just him, and he got those same kind of questions. I saw Adam Savage at a skeptics convention, and he's being peppered with much more deep and in-depth questions.
Okay.
So the audience is very different. It's a critical audience. They want to ask important questions, not trivia questions most of the time. So it is a different audience, very much so.
Okay. Oh, I see what you're saying. So they want to, like, you know, they're like, in episode 302, when you launched the balloon, why did you choose yellow rather than red? Because is it because of the dexterity of the rubber?
That is the dinner conversation, yes.
Oh, my God.
But, like, I was having discussions with some of these people. Like, I can't talk to Bill Nye. You know, he's just too, the science guy, he's just too much of a rock star to me. I have nothing to say. I can't think of anything to say. Or Neil deGrasse Tyson, I have a hard time talking to him because he's just huge. I don't have a problem talking to Richard Dawkins in the bar, though, or something like that.
Okay.
Those are the kind of people who are there. It's just weird. It's a weird, surreal experience. It's a treat.
No, I know what you mean. It's the same. That's the thrill of, and I use that term loosely, that's the reason for a lot of us go to these paranormal conferences, is the sort of the meet and greet or the hangout at the bar with people
yeah.
you know kind of thing. Because, and you know, because I've already heard all this stuff that I'm going to hear anyway, so.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I don't have that kind of attention span. I know that we talk for 2 hours on the show, but it's like, I know there are people listening. I wouldn't want. Mm-hmm. I can't really sit still for that long to at least rehash stuff that I've already heard before. But
right.
All right. So, are you? Where? This is a horrifying question to ask. I apologize, but I gotta know where would you? This requires tremendous level of self awareness. But where would you say you rank on the scale of skeptic celebrity then? If you're, yeah, I think you're kind of rising up the ranks. I heard you've been invited on the Joe Rogan show.
Yeah, now I got to be able to get to L.A. I did go to Los Angeles back in May to do a training session filmed for the JREF, so that will be on YouTube eventually, and so that hasn't come out yet. That would be a big audience as well, because they have a really large YouTube channel.
Yeah.
And the Huffington Post blog that I have, I think, gets some pretty nice coverage.
Yeah, that's a pretty big deal. I mean, to write for Huffington.
Well, it's a blog. I mean, it's not a reporter. The reporters get the coverage, I think. It's just a blog. But
yeah,
it's a great outlet. Yeah, I couldn't say no to that. But honestly, there aren't too many female skeptics, people who would be willing to talk about various subjects, so that's a plus. You know, they try to do diversity in these conferences, so they like to have me there because I'm the token female. I don't really mean that, but you know, they try to have a range of different kinds of people there.
But when we talked last time, you said there were all kinds of young women involved in skepticism. That's, you know, why I got interested in it.
not so much anymore. We've really undergone a change in the past couple of years. There's been a change.
Okay. What happened, though? They all leave?
This is just my opinion.
Okay. That's why we, yeah, that's why.
I am a little bit older than the 20-something crowd of young women and college students that came into skepticism. Mainly after the Bush years, you know, they were disgusted with religiosity and stuff like that. So they began to get more involved in mostly atheism activism, freedom of religion type stuff, secular activism.
Are we talking like borderline hipsters here?
Well, these are like in their 20s, so
okay.
They're not there yet.
Oh, all right.
They do have the colored hair and lots of tattoos and lots of piercings, and they're very free-spirited.
Yeah, I think that's a hipster. I think that might be a hipster, but right? We need an actual hipster to identify them. But go on. I'm sorry.
I'm not sure what the definition of that is. I know I'm not one.
Yeah, I'm too old to be a hipster myself. That's why I'm confused and frightened by them. But go on.
So looking at it from my point of view, I think they had different expectations of what was going to happen. They thought it was a social movement in a way that we can make huge sweeping changes, social justice, things like that. And there was a very large current of feminism involved as well. Gay rights was a big issue as well. And I think what they tried to do was inject some new ideas that really would send the mission off course. Really, our key issue is to promote science, skepticism, reason, free thinking. And they were off on a social justice course to do good in the world. And, you know, they're young and they were enthusiastic.
What does that even have to do with skepticism? That's confusing. Like
feminism?
No. Not feminism per se, but feminism, gay rights. I thought, like you're saying, it's taking it off the. What direction did they want to take skepticism in that? I don't understand. I'm confused by that.
And I honestly didn't either. It really didn't. Okay. It didn't apply to the way I thought the mission should be.
Didn't
feel right to me. It was really, that's a great thing. Social justice is a terrific thing. Go do that.
Absolutely.
There was a really good TAM. The amazing meeting, we call it TAM. There was a really good talk by a magician and a member of the JRF, Jamie Ian Swift, who talked about people trying to move the tent. We have this big tent that includes a lot of great topics and goals and missions and lists of things that we have to accomplish. Don't come into the tent, new person, and decide to go move it over here. You know, because we like our tent, and we're going to progress within the tent and not leave some people standing out in the rain, more or less.
Interesting. Who'd be standing out in the rain in this scenario? The old school skeptics?
Exactly.
Very
good. And people like me who did not want, you know, as a female, I didn't really want to talk about feminism.
Right, again, because I don't see how that applies to sort of advancing. I guess unless it's like feminism, you know, equal rights and representation for women in the sciences. Is that kind of like maybe what they were going for?
A little bit.
Okay.
Yeah. But for the most part, it didn't really apply. And you may know that it got people into trouble. There were some scandals.
It was quite the, I have that in my notes here. It was quite the scandalous summer for skeptics, if you pardon the alliteration. Mm-hmm. As I emailed you during the summer, I did confess to having a bit of schadenfreude over the whole thing, but that's just because, you know, I play for the believers.
We're human. Everybody's human. Everybody gets emotional. We don't react all that well when we get emotional. We don't act reasonably when we're emotionally involved in stuff. So I think that that's what happened.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I don't expect you to, like, take sides in these weird she said battles. It's just... Well, you know, every field has these sort of things that come bubbling up to the surface, you know, these personal grudges that turn into people have to take sides and everything. It's unfortunate that it happens, you know.
Yeah, and it's really hard to go through when they're your friends.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine. I try to stay out of these squabbles when they come up, but, you know, that's one of the other things I wanted to talk to you about. You have this online presence. You're quite prolific online. I'm impressed by your presence there online. But in a way, though, you have to endure the slings and arrows quite a bit. And I've noticed that you do get into some of these tiffs with various folks over various issues. And, I mean, don't you ever just want to throw up your hands and be like, you know, I'm not engaging as deeply with a lot of this stuff online with people. I'm just going to – because I'm the kind of person that's like, I'm just going to produce my content and I'm not getting involved in a lot of this stuff. And if it costs me – friendships, then I can live with that, you know. So, if you know what I mean, it's like,
I do, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah.
I'll tell you a story. Between my dad and my mom, they're like polar opposites when it comes to engaging with, like, people.
Yeah.
My dad would be like, no, it's okay, everything's fine, don't worry about it. And my mom is like, I'm gonna engage and I'm gonna yell at you. And I am both of them in one person. So I don't like conflict. I want things to go smoothly. I want the discussion to be congenial. But yet I see this stuff online and I feel like I have to engage and give my opinion. And I've learned over the past year not to do that. There is a whole bunch of control you have to find within yourself to say it's really not worth it. Where am I going to get with this conversation if I engage with this person?
Yeah.
And you just have to go through that list in your head. And I actually have some rules that I write down on little sticky notes to remind myself, don't go there.
Oh, you're such a scientist.
It's just, you can get yourself into a lot of trouble, and it's just not worth it. It's not worth it half the time.
More than half the time, but yeah.
Yeah, more than half the time, you're right.
Yeah.
And it has meant losing some of the people that I used to consider friends, but I see now that they weren't really friends. So.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, that's a lesson of life, I think, too, you know.
It is.
It's just, it's, people are, you know, most people are, I think most people are good people, but a lot of people, I say the majority of people are sort of, the world revolves around them. So if you're not helping to, you know, engage the rotation, then
right.
They think you're counterbalancing the whole thing.
Yeah, and I'm pretty self-conscious about stuff, so I don't think it's been bad. There's been rare occasions where I felt really offended, but that is very rare. It hasn't been bad. I hear some women talk about they can't go online without being sexually harassed or things like that. I don't get that, or I don't notice it. So it's not something that I drum up and for drama. I just don't like the drama.
Yeah, yeah. That's a weird thing to say. Not what you said, but what these women say. It's like, I cannot. Unfortunately, no one sexually harasses me. So, yeah, I just got that bad luck. But I empathize with them. You know, I've heard horror stories like that, but I can't even
right.
imagine what it's like. You know, it's a yeah. It's odd. Yeah, I feel bad for them, but you wonder. Yeah. You just wonder what. Well, the anonymity of the internet causes all these problems in and of itself, you know.
It is a huge contributor to that, yes.
And it's like, I'm sure you're old enough to remember. Maybe not some of our listeners may not recall, but like there was a time when weirdos could call your house and like breathe heavy on the phone and get off on it because they were because they were weirdos, you know. And
yeah.
Nowadays they can't do that anymore. So clearly they've taken their weird fetish to the internet just to.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. So that they can breathe heavily at you via instant message or direct tweet. And you're like, all right, dude, you're really weird and don't do that
mm-hmm.
again. So, yeah.
I did have one person call my house.
Oh, my God. Really?
Yeah. It was slightly disturbing. It was like a Saturday, and I'm sitting at my computer at my desk, and I get this phone call in the middle of a Saturday afternoon, and this guy starts rambling. He's from Canada, he said, and
oh,
he was referencing a story that I wrote on Doubtful News about a UFO incident, a farmer having UFO incident with his cattle. And he just rambled and rambled and rambled about being an informant from the Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, and that he was a Bernie Madoff informant.
What?
And he was just rambling incoherently for about 10 minutes.
Oh, my God.
And I said, exactly what is it that you want me to say or want me to do? And he says, well, I've seen your stories online, and you think about this stuff. And then he started rambling again for another 10 minutes. I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. What? Let's focus here. What exactly are you calling me for? And then he started to say things like, oh, I'm familiar with where you live. I pass by that area quite a bit on business.
Oh,
and then
Jesus.
I'm starting to get a little creeped out.
Yeah, I'm getting creeped out.
Yeah. Jeez. So I'm writing everything down while he's talking. And then I he got disgusted with me. And he said, oh, I can tell you don't care. Goodbye. And then I started Googling him and asking my friends, had they gotten phone calls like this before? It's really not that hard to find people online. Everything is not private anymore.
Right.
So, I mean, it's not that difficult to track somebody down if you really want to. And it turns out that he just does this to everybody. He does this to a lot of people, to reporters, journalists. So, and I haven't heard from him again. But next time that happens, I'm definitely calling the police just to be safe. But things like that, they're weirdos. Yeah, you're just going to have people who don't think anything of invading your life like that.
Yeah, that's a frightening story. I didn't even that came out of nowhere. But it's chilling. I think people are going to be creeped out when they hear that. That raises an interesting sort of thought bubble that came up while you were saying all that, though, because you said, you know, nothing's private online anymore and everything. And I guess, you know, this is kind of where we agree in a sense, because, you know, I've had people on, and I made the point on the show a few times, and people got kind of irritated with me that, you know, this whole NSA thing that came out over the summer, you know, it seemed like it was obvious anyway, that the government was clearly already listening to everybody and tracking everybody because they had the availability and ability to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but all the conspiracy theorists were like, you know, it's you know, touchdown for conspiracy theorists, yay. So I guess as a skeptic, you know, what's your response, I guess, to that line of thinking? Do you know what I mean? That they're like, you know, we were right. When it's like, but everyone else is kind of like, yeah, clearly you were right, and had to kind of begrudgingly, you know, or just smugly be like, of course, I already knew that.
Yeah, we all do that. We all look for confirming evidence for our beliefs, to bolster our beliefs. So, yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, it was like a gotcha moment, but it really wasn't. And I see that a lot, because people just want to have that opportunity to say, see, I told you so. And if you think about it rationally, it's really not that big of a deal.
Yeah.
It's a big deal. The news itself, the information, it still comes. We didn't know that. It's not surprising to me. I didn't follow it because it wasn't surprising.
Right, right. Sorry, I got momentarily bumped out there. And you broke up on me a little bit. But yes, I guess the question, though, is do you think it strengthens the idea of a government conspiracy, or do you just think that it's sort of, I don't know, just what governments do?
Yeah, I think it's just what governments do. I think people give a lot of credit to the government, but then on the other hand, say that they're jerks and they don't know what they're doing. Which is it? Are they masterminds? Are they geniuses? Or are they idiots that can't run the country? Which is it? Can't be both, can it?
Well, maybe. I mean, I guess the idea is that there's some people that know what's going on at the top, and then underneath are people that don't.
Yeah, I'm not big on secret keeping. I think they spill.
You think that? Okay, you broke up on me there again. I'm sorry, but you think that they.
I'm not moving anywhere either, but that's unfortunate.
I know. It's the cell phone. It's the cell phone, but we'll persevere. Hopefully, hopefully it won't come up again. Someone in the chat room says, that's what they want you to think, Sharon.
Of course, of course.
I don't know if they're being sarcastic or serious, because it's all in caps. So
I get that all the time.
What's that?
That's what they want you to believe.
Yeah, that you're being duped by the establishment.
Right.
Okay, well, there was no real thread to pull on that other than sort of the idea that the conspiracy folks logged a victory for themselves this summer on that one. But one other area that you've done a lot of discussion in, and when we first talked about it in our first conversation, I kind of like pushed it. The guy says it's Bob. That's, I don't know if that helps at all or not. But anyway, let's move on from Bob. It's the Ketchum thing. I joked when we first talked that it was the Honey Boo Boo of the paranormal, but in keeping with Honey Boo Boo, which got a season 2, the Ketchum thing is still going, and now they've released a video recently, And it seems to have, it's kind of been back in the news quite a bit the last few days and weeks. So as someone who's really dug into the Ketchum story, what's first of all, provide me, because I don't even really follow it that well. So first, give me a thumbnail on what exactly has been going on with this Ketchum story, and then explain to me why it's all a bunch of hokum, even though the reason why you need to do part A is because I already think that it's a bunch of hokum, if you know what I mean. I've already given up on following it, so it's, you know, take us through the whole thing, though.
Well, it actually began back in 2008 when she was apparently contracted to run the DNA test for the Josh Gates Destination Truth show.
Okay.
He had a sample that was purportedly from a Yeti. So she got the contract, and she's a veterinarian. She works with DNA, probably paternity-type stuff, you know, figuring out lineages of pets and animals, breeds, and stuff like that.
This is Ketchum.
Ketchum.
Okay.
And she's a veterinarian in Texas. She had her own business. That's what she did. And from there, it appears. Now, all I get is stuff from blogs or what people tell me or what is documented in various legal cases or whatever, that she really took to this subject of Bigfoot DNA and got involved with some people, maybe some not-so-great people to get involved with, but she did get funding to do this project where she would collect data, or she would collect samples and run DNA tests on these samples. But the funny part was, I wish I had the dates in front of me. I don't have the dates in front of me, but it was somewhere around 2010 that she copyrighted an idea for a media project about a tribe of humans. And it wasn't until 2012, where she really had all the data and announced that there, what she believed there was this new tribe of humans, where Bigfoot, according to her research, according to the DNA study, was a hybrid of an unknown ape and a human. So I thought that was funny, the timing of that.
Yeah, so she, like a media project being,
the idea.
Being sort of like a, I don't know, like a movie idea or a TV show idea kind of thing, or
I think
who
it was
knows.
Documentary, book.
Okay. Reality show, yeah. Maybe. All right.
But I thought the timing was odd. I mean, you don't come up with your theory before you've done the study. You come up with the hypothesis, yes. So I can't really say what was going on there. I'm kind of curious. I did a whole bunch of research on it from the very beginning, and I wrote a chronology that appeared in both Skeptical Brief, which is odd because it was the really long version, and the shortened version, the briefer version, appeared in Skeptical Inquirer. Now, the Skeptical Brief version is online now. I pressured them to get that online, and they actually put it online about a month before this latest thing started to happen. So that was good. I think they got a lot of hits from that. Although, what I have to say is that the media in the past week never looked at Ketchum's background. They hardly ever mentioned that in the stories that they wrote about her, where if you do a Google search, my chronology of the whole thing comes right up. Everything they would have needed to know about her to do a story was there, but yet they didn't look.
Yeah.
So that was kind of disappointing. So this latest stuff, that her paper, let's do another little chronology, mini chronology thumbnail sketch here. Her paper was leaked in November of last year. It was leaked on Facebook by one of her colleagues, Igor Burtsev.
Like as a friend, like
yes.
I don't really know.
He just came out and said, "I'm tired of waiting for this thing to be published. We have this great news. Here it is."
Yeah.
And I just imagine that she's sitting there, you know, doing a facepalm, going, "Oh, what did he just do?" But she came out with a press release that weekend. And that got media coverage. She had no results, but no study, no paper. She just had her word.
Yeah, this was last November when it, like, exploded.
Last November,
yeah.
Correct. In February, the paper was published on a website that was a journal that she looks like she purchased from another journal, changed from one journal to another, and it was the only paper published on there. So it was almost like a self-published paper. That's what it appeared
yeah.
to be. Not very scientific. She claimed it was peer-reviewed. It was peer-reviewed by some people who rejected it for a standard scientific publication, a large one.
Nature, right?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
But then she said it was peer-reviewed by this other journal, and then they chose not to publish it due to the controversy. I don't get that, because you could get a paper published in a journal. It's not difficult at all. There's thousands and thousands of scientific journals. If you pay them the fee, they'll publish it. It doesn't even have to be good. There are rankings of journals where you can publish in the better ones, like Science and Nature, that she wanted. Obviously, she wanted that attention, and the paper just was not of the caliber to do that. And then since the paper was eventually published for experts to look at, they don't see anything in there that's worth talking about. They were not impressed, and that's being kind.
Yeah. So why is she all of a sudden back in the news lately? I know there was a video or something, a terrible video that came out, but I also thought there was more. For some reason, I thought that the story like was regurgitated, even though it's been thoroughly debunked. Am I confused with this?
No.
Okay.
She has this ability to keep injecting herself into the media, and I'm beginning to think it's deliberate, really deliberate, where this is really dragging out. I mean, she was on radio shows and announcing this stuff way back in 2010. And now here we are in, you know, approaching 2014, and she's still pushing herself in the media, but we have nothing better to look at. This Erickson video, it's called the Erickson Project, was done not in conjunction with NELVA, but eventually at some point they got together and collaborated, where the idea was that she would have the science, the DNA, and he would have the video proof. And together, that would be a sell to the media.
Yeah.
You couldn't just have one. The two would reinforce each other. It's a great idea. Unfortunately, the study was junk, and the video was ridiculous. The video was supposed to come out in December, or in, when her paper came out, in December to February, when they were planning on releasing the paper. And all we got was a tiny little still. We got one little bit of it, just a still photo of what looked like a hairy rug lying on the forest floor, breathing. The breathing rug, I call it.
Yeah.
That's what it looks like. Looks like a breathing shag rug. Couldn't see much detail on it at all. Now, the latest video that came out, so there was this big press conference on October 1st where she's reannouncing her study, which we already knew about and had already been discredited. But out comes this video as well. And from the clips that I saw of the video, you know, it makes the Patterson-Gimlin film look like gold, because it's just terrible.
Yeah.
It's just not impressive at all.
I think I've
still
seen
the Patterson,
Patterson-Gimlin
film is still the best film.
Do you
what
have an opinion, not to put you on the spot, but do you have an opinion on the Patterson-Gimlin film, or you're in the inconclusive camp?
I'm inconclusive, but I'll just say this. If it's a hoax, it's the best one ever.
All right. That's
and
bold.
If it's real, we've been duped all this time. I don't think it's real. I'm leaning towards it's not real, but it's a fantastic hoax.
Now, what do you mean if it's duped? What do you mean if it's real? We've been duped all this time.
Because we never got anything better.
Okay, it's not duped then. We've been inadequate. We've been failing
failing.
Yeah.
Right.
Because there's a lot of people that believe in the Bigfoot. They're not duped. If it's real, then they're right.
Right. I see what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's because I do believe in Bigfoot. So, nobody's perfect, Sharon, okay?
I don't judge.
All right. So she keeps just getting, this is the thing. See, I've seen this a million times in the paranormal. This is why I called it the Honey Boo Boo thing, because this is just going to keep, it's going to be a long time before we're rid of this Ketchum story. It's just going to keep perpetuating itself. I think until the Brian Sykes stuff comes out. Maybe that'll push her, that then maybe she'll be seen as like out of the league of, you know, if he comes out with, you know, that he doesn't find anything, I think then people will immediately just forget all about the Ketchum thing because he's like a world-renowned scientist.
And it could be that she's just injecting herself into the media to keep herself fair or to keep and try and get more investors in her project to save the forest people, whatever. But, yeah, she got progressively stranger as time went on when she was pushing the idea that the paper was going to be published. She went through the she's seen them. She's interacted with them.
Oh, wow.
She found the stick structures, everything. It got really strange for a while, and she really lost credibility there. And then when the paper came out, and just the everything that surrounded the paper was ridiculous. The website was terrible. It was done in the 80s. It used stock photography of people with lab coats and testing. The paper was written very poorly, and not just because it was written poorly. It had references that were bogus.
Right. These were like April Fool's Day references, right, or something crazy
exactly.
like that?
Exactly, yeah. Sometimes science journals, just for fun, on April Fool's edition, will post these ridiculous papers. And two of them were about Bigfoot. She referenced them. Did she not read them? And then she blamed other people. She's been blaming other people. It's your responsibility. It's your paper. It's your name on it. You have to take the hit for it.
Right. Now, you've been one of the most outspoken critics of all this. Have you ever been in contact with her? Have you ever tried to, like, reach out to her or you know, get in touch?
She deletes my comments on Facebook.
Okay, so it's an antagonistic relationship, at least from her end.
She doesn't want. Now, actually, I defended her quite a bit because she got some really gross sexist remarks at many times, and that was the Bigfoot community who did not like her were very vocal about just ad hominem things. She's fat or she's ugly or whatever. It was just mean and it was stupid, and it showed how shallow they were.
Yeah, there's no place
for
that.
And I also defended her when other people said she's stalling. This whole year when we got nothing on this paper. Well, putting a paper in a scientific journal takes a long time. It could take up to a year. It could take more because there's changes that have to be made. So that was not her fault either. She was not stringing us along. It really did take that long. So I wanted to be fair. I really wanted to give her the benefit of the doubt. I just can't anymore. It's just all falling apart.
Yeah. But we'll be hearing more from her, I'm sure. Although...
I'm sure.
You know, I don't know what the... what. Now, like I said, I've only seen a little stills or whatever of this video. Are there actually people who are on board with this video? Because you'd hope it'd be just like, roundly debunked or roundly rebuffed, and people would be like, oh, give me a break. But I presume there's also people out there that will cling to anything, and they're probably like, this is the greatest thing since Patterson-Gimlin.
Yeah, there are some people who will support her no matter what. It's a part of the video, I don't know if you heard this part, where there's a still picture that they've matched to a Chewbacca mask.
Yeah, I've seen something about Chewbacca mask, yeah.
Yeah, it matches almost exactly. It's the body that they show, that the creature that they show looks too stiff in the face, doesn't look like a real creature. Some of the walking movements are extremely fakey looking. They look like a human trying to look like a monster. It's really not natural at all.
Yeah.
I don't think many people will be all that impressed. The people who are always impressed with everything will be impressed. But the people who are just looking at this with either on the fence or the person sitting on their couch looking at this for the first time is not going to be impressed.
Right. This would be.
I really don't think so.
Yeah. This would be akin to what my friend Greg Bishop calls UFO porn, which is just, you know, the blurry YouTube video that gets some people all worked up. You know, it's just UFO porn, but it's Bigfoot porn for the Bigfoot buffs. So.
And when I wrote in Huffington Post about this, I was really angry. And I'm really angry with Erickson and Ketchum for this because now Erickson says that he's delaying his documentary to release more of this footage.
Yeah.
And he's been delaying this for years. If they really have actual DNA of Bigfoot evidence and actual filming of these creatures, they are being completely unethical and really scummy to have given us what they've given us so far, because it's been terrible.
I see what you're saying, yeah.
You know?
Well, I would,
if you really...
I agree with you on ethical, but it's not, you know... I would just say, like, foolhardy in a way, you know? If they really have this stuff, they're fools for not releasing it ASAP.
If their intentions are pure, they really believe these creatures are there and they want to protect them, why would you waste more years hiding it and not releasing it to the world? You're going to make money regardless. But I get this feeling they're trying to always cut a TV deal or a book deal while they're waiting. And I find that so distasteful. As a scientist, I would like to bring out the knowledge to the world and share it. I don't care how much money I make from it. I want everybody to know what I've been working on and what I found. I don't get that feeling from these people.
Right, right. That's kind of like, we've talked about this, not you and I, but guests of mine, you know, we've talked about this sort of thing in the UFO community too. It's like the people, there are people who want to be the Newton of the whole thing and be the discoverer.
Oh,
and it's like, they're not really on board with the discovering. They're just really on board with being the discoverer.
Exactly.
So, it's depressing in a lot of ways. Now, someone in the chat room asked, what do you attribute the Native American folklore about Bigfoot to? That's an interesting question.
That is an interesting question, and I think that this happens in a lot of cryptids where people have the idea that if you go back in time, then you can find more sightings that you can now fit into the mold, and I think that that's a mistake because older cultures thought of these creatures completely differently, and if you equate the two, modern times with what they thought of it, it may not match up. Many of the Native Americans, from what I gather, thought of this Bigfoot creature as a spiritual animal. It was not real. It was not flesh and blood. It was a spiritual creature just like many other spiritual creatures that they had in their culture.
Okay.
So I don't think it's right to pluck one out and say, it's a real thing, we're going to use it as evidence.
Yeah.
I don't think that's right. I don't think it's going to work.
Well, yeah. I mean, you can't really do much with it, I guess, to prove the Bigfoot, right? That's kind of what you're saying.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. But I think it's grasping backwards and grabbing stuff that you could plug into your idea right now. And the context is wrong. So I don't think you could reasonably do that. I'd like to see more about that, but that's what I think about it right now.
Right, right. Well, yeah, there's nothing you can really, like I said, there's nothing you can really do about it with the information. Mm-hmm. So
correct. Yeah.
It's a difficult thing. It's the kind of thing that it'll either be confirmation down the line if they find out that Bigfoot's real, or, you know, I guess it'll if they never. That's the tricky part about something like Bigfoot. If you can't really ever prove that it doesn't exist. It's like you can't prove a negative, so it'll always
right.
just sort of be this lingering thing that people will be like, well, what about this? So It's the challenge of the paranormal from your side of the fence too. You know, it's trying to. You can't prove a negative, so you always just have to be one step ahead of the people that are maybe using the wrong information to prove their point.
Yeah, and topics sort of go away for a while and resurface, and Bigfoot wasn't real. He was popular in the 70s, not in the 80s. Now he's resurfaced again. He's more popular than ever. They're unsinkable rubber ducks. You can't ever expect they're going to go away for good.
Yeah. It's odd. Now, tell me about this article you wrote, because I love the Bigfoot, or I love Bigfoot, and I'm really into that whole thing, but I'm also a huge enthusiast of the UFO research field. And you wrote a really interesting piece at the PsyCop website about UFO research, asking if it can be scientific. And I thought that was really interesting, because there's a schism in the UFO field right now.
Right. And that's what prompted the article.
Schism. Okay, well, tell me about it then.
Well, I, that's my thing. I want to know if we could take a look at these subjects and be scientific about them, or if they're sort of lost causes, if they're really off track. And I assume that the answer to can it be scientific is yes. It isn't now, but it could be with changes. And I think that's what I found. And there are some people in the UFO community right now who want to go that route, and I think that's great. And I got in, happened to get in touch with some of them and asked them questions and how they felt, and they were really supportive of what I was thinking and what I wanted to do. And that's a good feeling when you find these researchers who are enthusiastic about studying it, but yet want to hear what opinions the other side has to say. That's really a commendable position to take. And I wish the ghost hunters would be more like that. But the UFO community seems to have gone through a bit more growing up and going through these phases. And a lot of the old timers are gone away now. They've died or they've moved on. And I think when that happens, you get these newer people with different ideas that come in and maybe want to approach it in a different way. And that's a great thing. So I asked them about that, and I asked some skeptics as well, do you think it could be scientific? And some of them said, well, it's a touchy subject because, gee, it's just an observation. That's all we have are observations. We very rarely have any physical evidence, and they're damn hard to spot.
Right.
So it's a tricky subject.
Yeah, well, that's the supremely difficult challenge of the whole thing. You know, it's sort of like studying weather phenomenon or something. You kind of have to, you know, provided that the UFOs are...
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, it could be weather phenomenon, so I guess it does apply. You know, it's like, whatever it is, you got to rely on it to really make the first move. But I guess you ask the question in the article, can it be scientific? And I guess my question, I think we kind of broached this on the original interview that we did, but it's like, you know... I know you wouldn't want to be in charge of ufology, but if you were, you know, I guess what steps would you take towards making it more scientific?
That's a good question. There's a couple things. The community aspect is important in any scientific endeavor. You have to be able to have good data and share it among others.
Yeah.
And I think that they're moving towards that. I think that the UFO community had that, a start on that already. MUFON had a huge database, or has one. But the data in it, from what I've heard, is not good. It hasn't been cleaned up. There's a lot of garbage and noise in there, which is bad. Because when you're trying to sort through data and you've got all this noise and you don't know what's noise and what's real. So that's a problem. Cleaning up the data, making good observations, having a standard way of collecting information, having a standard training for people who are investigating these things, and then being able to have a protocol where you can address the possible explanations. And I talked to some researchers like Antonio Perez about this. I said, well, how do you investigate these days? He says, well, I can use software to figure out if there are planes or aircraft in the area. I can use software to figure out if it was a planet or a satellite or the space station, which is great. And those are the kind of tools that need to be used every single time.
Look, Todd, I know you're a big conspiracy theorist, okay? And you believe everything, man.
It's not
you're
true.
So naive, man.
There are no aliens in Roswell, and contact lenses aren't made out of amoebas.
They are,
they
too,
are, dude.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Wait, did you see that?
What?
Chupacabra! He just ran down the aisle, Todd!
You better find him.